Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Nightlight. Step away from the mainstream and gather around as we enlighten the world and our realities and travel this cosmic journey we call life. Join us as we share with you and provide that beacon that can guide us all to a better way. Explore with us as we examine a metaphysical montage of spiritual insights, covering everything from the mundane to the magical, UFOs to unicorns, and everything in between. This is a time of awakening, of sharing and evolving, of spreading our wings and soaring on the cosmic breath of creation. Come and join with other light-minded spirits as we weave our lights together to seek understanding, enlightenment, and with a little luck, some wisdom. This is Nightlight, a reminder that you are never alone.
Welcome everyone, including all the Clarices out there, to what should be one of the more unique Nightlight episodes. I've actually met and had breakfast with our guest, Mark. No, Mark is not an alter ego or another personality. Mark Olshaker is an Emmy Award-winning documentary filmmaker and author of several true crime books. His latest co-authored book just became available. It is entitled The Killer's Shadow, the FBI's Hunt for a White Supremacist Serial Killer. You may also know him from his Mindhunter, which became the Netflix series. His website is mindhuntersinc.com. And Inc. is like incorporated. Since Nightlight covers a lot of unusual history, here is a little bit more background on the two Marks. We met during the Friday conference at the Twilight Zone 60. A convention where he was going to be speaking over the weekend Mindhunter, and Mark gave me his card. Next morning, Mark and his wife were staying in the same hotel, and they sat behind us at breakfast. Then Mark Dweziak showed up so I could get an autographed copy of his Shawshank Redemption book for our loyal listener, the Red Dragon Rider. And Mark was over at the table with all the bacon and eggs, and he's pouring the batter into the waffle thing and the griddle, and turn it over to get the waffle out. And I think Barbara and the Red Dragon Rider have photos of the breakfast, and so there we have three Marks at the breakfast. And to make it even more Twilight Zone-ish, my dear friends Helen and Johnny Holmes were sitting there too. So it was a very unique experience with this group. I was going to get another copy of Mindhunter from Mark Olshaker, and I couldn't find his card. It got stuck in the corner of the suitcase or something. I eventually found it when I got home, And so I'd have the front desk call his room, and then Mark realized that all of his books were in Anne's trunk, and she was staying in another hotel. And so I think Mark and I should be profiled as incompetent serial killers, but that's a good thing. And I can read a little passage here that pertains to that. I also thought there was a high chance that, being on the run, he would be too stressed and disorganized in his thinking to carefully plan to execute a bank robbery, which is a high-risk crime under the best circumstances. So there's some scientific profiling that Mark and I are good guys. Hi, Mark.
How are you, Mark? I'm getting confused with all the Marks now.
Yeah, I know.
And also to Mark Dowidziak and I also went to the same university, so that makes it even more complicated.
Yeah. I mean, only something like this could happen at a Twilight Zone conference.
You know, I was listening to your intro. I was hearing about all the cosmic stuff. I was thinking, gee, I'm not going to have very much that's cosmic to contribute. But I guess we're getting cosmic now, aren't we?
I think your information is going to fit in somewhere between the UFOs and unicorns.
Oh, okay.
So that's.
Well, I don't claim to have seen either one, although my 6-year-old great niece is totally into unicorns now, so I guess I've probably seen more episodes of My Little Pony than most people my age.
Okay, well, you're never too old to learn something.
I guess not.
So we're going to be presenting a lot of stuff we normally don't cover, but you have bring a compassionate view to crime, and that does fit into Barbara's mission statement for the show. But since we can combine here at the outset of the show with, we met at the Twilight Zone conference, and have the prologue of your book is taken from the He's Alive Twilight Zone episode. It was from one of the hour-long third or fourth season episodes. That's a good way to get the show started. So, you've been friends with the Serling family for a long time. You were a speaker at the conference. There's a story there. So can you tell us a little bit about?
Well, you've thrown a lot of things at me, Mark. So let's see, where will we start? I certainly consider myself a devotee of the late great Rod Serling. I was fortunate enough to know him well during the last 10 years of his life. I'm afraid I'm going to be dating myself here by telling you approximately when that was, but as going back as far as junior high school, when the Twilight Zone was first on, I was a huge fan, and I became a great devotee of Rod's. And it just so happened that at the that my mother, who was a teacher, a public school teacher, an English teacher by trade, was also volunteering for the local radio station at American University. And that was really the beginnings of educational radio and television. This was really the precursor to NPR. And at the time, Rod was the president of the Academy of Television, Motion Picture Arts and Sciences, the ones that give out the Emmy Awards. And eventually I was fortunate enough to win one, but let's go way back in time here. So it turns out Rod was coming to Washington for something, and he was going to address the local chapter of the Television Academy. And my mother, being in educational broadcasting at that point, found out about it, and she brought me there. So I got to meet him, and it was, you know, this was like meeting my hero. I must have been like 14 at the time. And when I got into the room, it was at one of the big hotels, and it was one of the conference rooms, and he was sitting up there at the front table before it started with his brother Bob Serling, who was also a writer, an aviation writer. And I kind of timidly walked up to him and presented my paperback copy of Stories from the Twilight Zone and asked him to sign it, and we engaged in conversation, and he was just couldn't have been nicer, more supportive. I mean, just generous. I don't know how many good things to say about him. He gave a speech. I think it was very inspiring. I don't remember much about the speech, but afterwards I wanted to talk to him again, but he and Bob rushed right out afterwards. And I didn't understand why until the next day, when in the newspaper, in Lawrence Laurent, who is the television critic of the Washington Post, his column said that he had gone right to the hospital after that, that he'd been experiencing chest pains, but he didn't want to disappoint the people who were waiting to hear him speak, so he went to the hospital right afterwards. And I was very impressed that he still wanted to do it. I sent him a get well card in care of the hospital, and I just figured it was a nice thing to do. And I would say maybe a week or 10 days later, I got a letter back from him saying how much he appreciated it and how it was the best medicine and all of that. And frankly, Mark, that began our relationship, and I stayed in touch with him, and I saw him a number of times over the years, and He eventually got to read some of my early scripts when I became a professional writer, and I must say I was absolutely devastated when he died. You mentioned Anne before, his younger daughter, who has written a biography of him, and Anne remains one of my closest friends. So that's how I started with Rod, and to tie it all together into a big bow here, he was a tremendous influence on me and my writing, and I was very pleased that the book that I've just published with John Douglas, the FBI's behavioral profiling pioneer and the original Mindhunter, that we could start with an epigraph from Rod Serling. And I want to bring it back to something else that you mentioned, Mark, which is writing about crime with compassion. And I'm really glad you brought that up, because that really is what we try to do. I've written now, I don't know how many books with John, probably 8 or 9 at this point, on different subjects relating to criminal justice, profiling, behavioral science. And one thing we always try to do is say there are no Hannibal Lecters in the world, as glamorous a character as he is. The ones that we really care about are the victims. Everything that law enforcement does is for the victims, and that's where the compassion has to be. So I'm really glad you brought that up. But if you want, since we're talking about the killer's shadow, which really is unfortunately very relevant today in terms mm-hmm. of white supremacy and all that. Perhaps I should, if you like, and tell me if you don't, because I'm very easy on these things, perhaps I should read the epigraph, which is the opening monologue to
sure.
that Twilight Zone episode you mentioned, and
yeah.
then we can get into talking about the book. All right. It's about, I think, was it Dennis Hopper, I believe, Mark, who was playing the part?
Peter Vollmer.
Yeah, playing a guy named Peter Vollmer, who is essentially a neo-Nazi, he's kind of a loser, he's down on his luck, and not to give it away, because the episode is 60 years old now, but the spirit of Hitler comes and advises him how to become much more important. But anyway, let me read the epigraph, which was Rod's opening monologue. Portrait of a Bush League Führer named Peter Vollmer, a sparse little man who feeds off his self-delusions and finds himself perpetually hungry for want of greatness in his diet. And like some goose-stepping predecessors, he searches for something to explain his hunger and to rationalize why a world passes him by without saluting. That's something he looks for and finds is in a sewer. In his own twisted and distorted lexicon, he calls it faith, strength, truth. But in just a moment, Peter Vollmer will ply his trade on another kind of corner, a strange intersection and a shadow land called the Twilight Zone. Now, why this is so meaningful and so relevant to what I did was that Rod Serling, when this really prefigured the person I was writing about, Joseph Paul Franklin, who was a for want of a better term, a white supremacist serial killer who, in a three-year period from 1977 to 1980, killed 22 people, African-Americans, mixed-race couples, and Jews, all because of his twisted mind and his mission-oriented prejudice. He also, many people might remember him as the one who wounded Larry Flint, the publisher of Hustler, and Vernon Jordan, the attorney and civil rights leader who just died a couple of weeks ago. So this was a man who was completely filled with hate. It was his mission to start a race war. And unfortunately, even though he is dead, his spiritual children live on. And I think that's what we've seen in so many instances lately, whether we're talking about Charlottesville in 2017, I believe it was, whether we're talking about Dylann Roof in Charleston, South Carolina in 2015. Unfortunately, Joseph Paul Franklin has many spiritual children today, and I think we have to understand that, and the more we understand it and the more we combat this this kind of hate and intolerance, the better off we'll be. And I might say parenthetically that going back to what we were talking about before, I think this was, in Rod Serling's opinion and view, the ultimate evil in the world was prejudice and discrimination against people just because of who they were or what they looked like. So I hope the spirit of Rod has stayed with me through all of this.
Yeah, I think the line that he wrote, perpetually hungry for want of greatness,
yes.
Fits into what Franklin really never got from home, and what joining his brief stints in the Klan and other white supremacist groups seemed to supply for him.
But, I think you're absolutely right, Mark. Yeah, I think you've hit the nail on the head. all of these people who claim to do what they do for spiritual reasons, for missions, these are deeply inadequate people. And you know, one of the things we were talking about on the phone before you mentioned to me, mm-hmm. when we were preparing for this show, was the relationship between these kind of people and other serial killers who in most cases kill for some kind of sexual gratification or vicarious sexual gratification. But what we find is in all of these people, and we can be talking about white supremacists, we can be talking about Muslim extremists, the kind of people who carried out the 9/11 attacks. It doesn't matter who we're talking about. These are all people who find a deep inadequacy in themselves, and they're looking for something bigger, something to hang their hat on, if you will. And so they look for an organization which can give them validity, whether it's the Klan or whatever. And they are looking for some kind of validation through this. And one of the ways they get validation is to find people who they consider either inferior to them, like the Klan does and the American Nazi Party does with African Americans, or people that they consider the enemy, who are secretly manipulating everything, like the Jews. And Joseph Paul Franklin, who had never met a Jew in his life growing up in rural Alabama in the 1950s, he became convinced through what he read that the Jews were secretly controlling the world. You've heard all the tropes, the media, the banking mm-hmm. industry, all kinds of things, and that the black people were just their pawns and their dupes, and that they were going, and that the powers that be were going to use them to replace white people, which is something you still hear today. I mean, one of the things that really struck me about, and I've written about this toward the end of the book, in the Charlottesville marches in 2017, you heard two slogans being chanted by these torch-bearing skinheads marching down the street at night. One of them was Blood and Soil, which was one of the prime Nazi slogans, and the other was Jews Will Not Replace Us. And I think that shows that this kind of outlook is still with us. And one of the scary things is, back in Joseph Paul Franklin's time in the 1950s, 60s, 70s, and 80s, you know, this was all kind of one-to-one. You had to read books, you had to get pamphlets, that kind of thing. Now with the internet, God knows how many sites there are where this kind of hate, conspiracy theories, the QAnon type things, and even much worse, are just promulgated all over the place, and it's very difficult to control.
And I do have a question. We can work in later about computers. There's. Mm-hmm. When John is getting the behavioral sciences unit started in the mm-hmm. Late 70s,
mm-hmm.
There's like one computer in the off. It's not all that.
Yeah.
It's nowhere near what it is today.
No, it was a completely different kind of atmosphere, and
yep.
Also a lot of these theories were untried. In a way, mm-hmm. The way the book starts actually is Joseph Paul Franklin has been arrested in Florence, Kentucky, in 1980, but he's escaped, and there's great concern because they believe that he's responsible for a number of these crimes. He's very dangerous. He's very mobile. He's been able to go all over the country on his own. And In 1976, he had written a threatening letter to then-candidate Jimmy Carter, who is now president. And the president was about to make a, remember this is 1980, the president was about to make a campaign swing through the South. And the Secret Service was extremely worried that with this guy on the loose, that the president was a prime assassination target. Remember, Jimmy Carter was a Southerner who promoted civil rights, and so he was considered by people like Franklin to be a traitor to his region and a traitor to his class. So what had happened, and his race. So what happened was, as you say, the behavioral science unit and the profiling program at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, were in their very early stages. And David Cole, who was the director of the Civil Rights Division of the FBI, called John into headquarters and said, we've got this guy who's on the loose, and we want you to do a fugitive assessment of him, try to figure out, you know, we're going to give you all the information about him. You study his cases and try to figure out where he's going to be and what he's going to do. So this was kind of a make or break task and assignment for John and the small group of profilers at that point, because while they had already done a number of important cases with local police departments, this was the first time FBI headquarters itself had called them in to do a case. So, and, you know, this was not that long. Let's see, I believe J. Edgar Hoover died in 1972, so his long shadow was still very much draped over the FBI, and, you know, that was sort of just the facts, ma'am. We just do investigations. We don't do this touchy-feely psychology stuff. So the whole idea of behavioral profiling was still very much on the line in terms of whether it was going to be used as an FBI tool. It wasn't, you know, in popular culture, it wasn't a thing like it is now. So this was really, this book really goes back to the origins of the program.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think the killer shadow fits in with what Barbara and I want to do with the, you know, looking at history. And, you know, we're seeing a relatively recent an aspect of recent history evolving. And, you know, a lot of us were alive at that time, and we remember it. You know, we could get into the Wayne Williams,
Which was just about at the same time, by the way.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, you have that going on too, and you know, there's a very interesting section about how he was caught, what some of John's tactics were to capture him. So, you know, hopefully a lot of the listeners are, you know, starting to put, you know, recreate, you know, what their childhood, seeing what was linking all these different events at that time. I think you do a great job.
Oh, thank you. Well, you know, and in a way, the Wayne Williams case that you refer to, popularly known as the Atlanta Child Murders of 1979, 80, and 81, that was kind of the opposite of the Joseph Paul Franklin case in a way, because you had – I mean, you had a city completely under siege in a way. You had all of these African-American children and teenagers, mostly boys, but girls as well, and they were disappearing, and then their bodies were being found later on, and this was an absolute horror. And you know, cast your mind back to 1980. It hadn't been that long since, you know, the modern civil rights movement was at its height. And the assumption at the time was, this is, remember, and this is Georgia, which had been the scene of many, unfortunately, many lynchings over the decades. And a lot of the people in town and as well as the police department were thinking, this is some kind of Ku Klux Klan type operation where they are killing our black children, and they are making a statement about this. And and so it was going on, and as I say, you know, as you know, this was a national story. The police chief, the mayor, Maynard Jackson, who was the first black mayor of Atlanta, they were totally under siege to do something about this. And so reluctantly, Child Murders Task Force called in John and one of his profiling partners, Roy Hazelwood, asked them to come down and consult on the case and look around. And once John and Roy were taken to the sites where the kids had disappeared, these were all poor children. They lived in disadvantaged neighborhoods and really ghetto-type neighborhoods. And the first thing that John and Roy said was, this is not the Klan. This is not that kind of political killing. In fact, this is not even a white person or white people who are doing the killing. And they said, well, how do you know? And they said, well, look, we went to all the sites where they disappeared, and we were the only white people there. I mean, we stood out prominently like sore thumbs. And you have more than a dozen murders at this point and disappearances, and you don't have a single eyewitness to any of this. There's no way that a white man or even a woman could have been in these neighborhoods and not been spotted. And second of all, this is not the way the Klan or other hate groups operate. I mean, the whole idea of a lynching, the whole idea of all of those political type killings was to create a statement, to take credit for it, to create terror, because that's what lynchings were. They were domestic terrorism. And nobody's claimed credit for it. Nobody has made any kind of public statement. There's no ritualistic presentation of the bodies. There's no communication, nothing like that. So we believe that for a lot of reasons which we could go into, but we believe this is a single black male who is doing this. We think he is attracted to these children and young adults. He's personally inadequate, so he can't deal with people his own age. And the other thing they realized from previous cases and study of, and let's go back for a minute and say, all of this starts with John and his partner, Robert Ressler, going in the early 1970s and mid-1970s, just visiting prisons throughout the country and interviewing serial killers and other violent predators to kind of figure out what was going on in their thinking and try to correlate what was going on in their minds before, during, and after the crime. And that's certainly what the first season of Mindhunter on Netflix, based on our first book together, John and me, is all about. So one of the things that they realized was that most of these killers, this kind particularly, would be following the news very carefully, the media, and he could be manipulated that way. And so when they started announcing that the medical examiner was finding forensic evidence, hair and fibers and things like that on the body, John predicted, all right, he's going to take advantage of that. He's going to start throwing his victims into the river so that they can wash away all of the evidence. And that's ultimately how they caught Wayne Williams, was they staked out all the bridges along the Chattahoochee River for about 6 weeks. And they weren't really getting very far. But the last night of the stakeout is when they one of the police cadets who was manning one of the bridges, he saw a car drive to the middle of a bridge on the Chattahoochee, heard something plunge into the water, and saw this car come back, and that was Wayne Williams.
Well, it's little details like that that you bring up in your book, and you know, we can get into more later through the show, but it's fascinating reading about some of these observations that John made over just watching how people act.
Yeah, I mean, I think, and you start putting these things together, and at first it seems like black magic. Well, how do you, how do you know just from looking at a crime scene that the victim, that the perpetrator is going to have a speech defect or a stutter, and you know, and but then when you start working it out and explaining where the logic comes from, you know, it makes perfect sense. And I guess I've been with John enough over the years that I've learned how to do that too. So I can give you an example if you want. Years ago, Mark Furman, who was famous right. and notorious from the O.J. Simpson case, he had a radio show on in Spokane, Washington, and he used to like to have me on as a sort of a, I guess, an expert guest on violent crime. And it so happened that at a certain point, and I'm not giving anything away because this was a number of years ago, so I'm not interfering with any ongoing cases. I was on the show, and the show was live, and he said, and they were having a string of serial murders in the Spokane area. And the victims were, I hate to say it, but kind of typical victims. They were prostitutes mainly, because unfortunately they're very approachable by bad people, because their business is to take in strangers. So this had gotten up to about 14 or 15 victims already. And Mark said to me, he said, well, we've gotten some inside information from a source in the police department, and they say they have DNA on nine of the DNA on nine of the victims. So what can you tell us about the unknown subject, the unsub, as we say, or the unknown offender from that piece of information I just gave you? So I started sweating. I said, gee, how am I going to solve this one? You know, just you got DNA on nine of them, and you want me to tell you what kind of you want me to profile the guy just from that, so the killer? So I thought for a moment, and I said, well, here's what I would say. If you have a killer who's this good at it, who's this adept, getting away with these, he's not leaving blood on the scene. He's not being injured enough to leave DNA, in his blood DNA on the scene. So I've got to assume that the DNA is from semen, and you know, I mean, and prostitutes are very careful about not being penetrated that way so that they pick up any disease, get pregnant, etc. So a prostitute would not let him deposit semen on her or near her. So that tells me one thing. That tells me that he is going back to the body dump sites and he is masturbating on the corpses or trying to have sex with them. So what I would say is, the one thing I can say is your killer is a necrophiliac, and the way you're going to catch him is by surveilling the crime scenes, and eventually you're going to get him that way. And sure enough, that's what happened.
No,
I mean, it's not. Okay. They would have gotten him anyway. It wasn't that I came up with this idea. It's just that because of my experience with John and learning the way he thinks and learning the way profiling works, I was able to work my way through the logical process.
Yeah, there's that's very similar to the observations you and John make in Mindhunter with the discussion about where the killer is strangling people, but what he's really doing is acting out his own failed suicide attempts by strangulation.
Ah, that's interesting. Yeah. Go on. Yeah.
I was going to say, that's getting pretty weird. But just one of your.
I have to say, and I'm not trying to be flippant, but you got some pretty weird people out there. When we talk about people who most of your listeners probably have heard of, like Dennis Rader, the BTK strangler who terrorized Wichita, Kansas for many years. That's just what he was into, what is called autoerotic asphyxiation. He would practically,
right.
he would dress up in the women's clothes of his victims and strangle himself almost to the point of passing out and get an erotic high out of that. And it was, I guess you could say there was a certain amount of transference there because his preferred way of killing his victims was through strangulation, which is how he got the name, which in fact he gave himself in anonymous letters that he wrote to the media because it's just like we were talking about with Franklin. These, to a serial killer, whatever else is going on in his life, this is the most important aspect. This is the most important thing in his life. And so he wants credit for it. And I'll say tangentially here, Mark, that you're almost always going to hear me say he, and this is not sexism on my part. The overwhelming majority of violent predators are men. We can talk about the few categories of serial killers where you do find women, but by and large, they are men. Even though women
right.
might come from the same abusive, really terrible background, they don't manifest it in the same way. They take it out on themselves and are self-abusive rather than striking out against other people by and large. It's, some people have said that almost all violent crime is performed by somebody on drugs or on a drug, and that drug is testosterone.
That makes a lot of sense. It probably is the best explanation for why you find much more male serial killers than women.
Sure.
Easy explanation. Besides the you know,
and women don't tend to be sexual predators in the same way that men do. I mean, that may, you know, part of that is biologically driven, but a lot of it is in the head. It really is.
No, and you know, besides, you know, the few really odd examples that we just discussed, you also have observations like, I had observed that orderly, compulsive people tended to drive darker cars. Okay, how do you figure that out? I'm sure Barbara drives
a black
car.
I think it is observational, and I think what it came down to is, and of course, this is not universal, but people who are obsessive, people who are very orderly, meticulous in other ways, very ordered in their lives, tend to be more serious people. And serious people consider darker cars more serious. It's just the way it is. They don't favor sort of bright, happy colors. And then the other thing, since we're getting into the whole automobile thing, another thing that we have which we can often tell from the behavior at the crime scene is if this is somebody who is, we can predict that they might be driving a, what we call a police type vehicle, like Wayne Williams did in the old days. It could be a Chevy Caprice, a Ford, Ford Crown Victoria, which was the favored car of police departments for a long time. You know, any sort of big American muscle sedan could be considered a police-type vehicle. And these are people who really, a lot of them were police wannabes. They had tried to become policemen but couldn't. But they were, and this also goes to a lot of what's, you know, the current public dialogue is about, but these people wanted to be, these people we're talking about wanted to be police officers for all the wrong reasons, because they wanted the power, they wanted to be able to control other people. It wasn't to serve the public, it wasn't to preserve the public's safety. This was a manifestation of power. And, you know, since we're talking, you know, on the day that the Derek Chauvin trial ended in a guilty plea, I mean, I've never met former Officer Chauvin, and don't expect to. But just looking at the tape over and over again, this was somebody who was really, seems to me, was asserting his control, his dominance, almost as in a criminal way. It's like saying, all right, in any test of manhood between you and me, I'm the cop, so I'm going to win. And this is very close to criminal behavior in and of itself.
Okay, and you have examples in your Mindhunter where suspects later in the interviews with them, that it became a pattern where what John was seeing, that they wanted to be police officers when they were kids. If something happened in the neighborhood, you know, they were probably the ones who did it, but you know, they, you know, would talk with the mingle with the cops and ask them, oh, do you have any descriptions of the perpetrator, you know, something like that. You have all that.
Sure, you see that over and over again, where where a perpetrator tries to interpose himself into the case, becomes friendly with cops to because he wants to be like them, and at the same time he wants to know what they know so that he can carry out his crimes. You also, I mean, somebody like Joseph Paul Franklin, who we were talking about, I mean, he wanted to be a police officer too. His uncle, as I recall, had been a police officer in the South, but he had a serious, eye accident when he was a young child. So his vision was very poor in one eye, and they wouldn't accept him. So what's very interesting is, I'll give you another example. I have a good friend who also has written a number of books about famous crime cases, whether it's O.J. Simpson or the JonBenet Ramsey case. His name is Lawrence Schiller, and he's also a very prominent photographer. Larry Schiller, when he was a young boy, had a serious accident that left him blind in one eye. Now, this is very similar to Joseph Paul Franklin. The difference is Joseph Paul Franklin tried to compensate for this and did compensate for this by becoming an expert marksman. He became he became really good. As a rifleman, he became an excellent sniper. He could hit a target with a telescopic sight from hundreds of yards away, which he did over and over again. Larry Schiller, on the other hand, compensated for his eye injury by becoming a photographer, a completely different kind of way of compensation. And it turns out he was in a lot of the right places at the right time, and he had some very famous photographs. A lot of the photographs you've seen of Marilyn Monroe coming out of the swimming pool, Larry took. Larry took pictures in Dallas around the time that Lee Harvey Oswald was assassinated. A lot of the pictures that you've seen that you probably wouldn't even attribute to anybody, Larry Schiller took. So my point is, from the same kind of negative influence, you can go one way or the other. Another example is Gary Gilmore, the subject of Norman Mailer's epic book, The Executioner's Song. He was the first man executed for murder in the United States in 1977 after the Supreme Court lifted its stay of executions. He came from a very bad background. So did his brother Michael Gilmore, who became a very prominent music writer and social critic for Rolling Stone magazine. So, you know, you can go different ways. Or here's another example. As you mentioned on the phone when we were talking before, John and I wrote a book about the Unabomber right after Theodore Kaczynski was identified and arrested. Ted Kaczynski and his brother David had very similar backgrounds, and they both had some family problems, some antisocial problems. Both of them went away to live by themselves for a while. As you know, Kaczynski, the Unabomber, lived in a cabin all by himself. David lived in a cave, I think, in New Mexico for a while. And yet, Ted, who is brilliant, became a public criminal, and David became a social worker. So they each manifested their experience in different ways.
And you know, you do when you do get to the section of Franklin's growing up in a dysfunctional home. Obviously, he made some wrong choices, but his you also write, we see more cases of brothers raised under the same bad circumstances going in opposite ways.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Now, in his case, two brothers. I think his brother ended up in jail too. Not as a murderer, but he also had two sisters who turned out okay. So, you know. But I mean, look. There's no doubt. Joseph Paul Franklin had a terrible upbringing. He was beaten by both his mother and his father. His father was a drunk. It was a terrible life. It was an impoverished life, and he was always looking for a way out. So, I mean, I think the lesson here, Mark, is that almost all of the violent predators that and offenders that we have studied had a bad background in one way or another. And usually, you know, constantly in our books, we're talking about the nature versus nurture question and argument. And in most cases, with the kind of people we write about, the kind of offenders, it really is a combination of both. You've got somebody who is hardwired for impetuosity, for risk-taking, for maybe antisocial behavior, has anger management problems. And then when you put him in this bad background and don't give him any positive reinforcement, or he thinks the world is against him, that's a recipe for danger. And, you know, people often ask John Douglas, you know, can you tell somebody who as a school child who has the potential to grow up in this antisocial manner? And he says, yes, I can, but so can any good elementary school teacher. And he's right about that. So, you know, if there's no intervention at an early age, you've got a real problem. And as John says, you know, if you're waiting for people like me and police officers and detectives to solve your social problems, by the time you get to us, it's too late. I mean, all we can do is try to catch them and prevent them from doing damage. And I think one of the themes that we deal with over and over again, Mark, is the idea that yes, if you have a bad background like that, it is understandable that you could have real psychological problems and that you could, to put it plainly, become a fairly messed up adult. But that doesn't mean that you are compelled to kill or hurt other people. That remains a personal choice. And so if there's one word that is probably as important conceptually as any other word we've ever written about, that word is choice. They always have a choice about what they do. No one's compelling them to do it. They're not compelled, unless they are. You know, I would make the argument, and I don't think you would disagree, that anybody who kills in cold blood or for the personal satisfaction of it is mentally ill on some level. But that doesn't mean that they are insane by the legal definition or incapable of controlling their actions. There is an old saying, which I think we talked about in Mindhunter, a test called the policeman at the elbow. And the question is, if this person who commits this heinous act, if there were a uniformed policeman watching, would he still be compelled to do it? And if the answer is no, then he can control himself. I mean, very few of the serial killers that we have dealt with are what I would call insane or incapable of controlling their actions. Now, every once in a while, you do get one who is, like Richard Trenton Chase, for instance, who killed young women so he could drink their blood to stay alive. And he honestly believed he had to do this. And when he was caught and put in prison, he would catch birds and kill them and drink their blood. So, I don't know if any of your listeners have ever tried to drink blood. I hope not, but it's really difficult to do. I mean, it will make you sick. It will make you throw up very quickly if you try to do that. So somebody who had a compulsion to drink blood, whether human or animal blood, that's somebody who's really, really out there.
Okay. Speaking of...
I know we're jumping around a lot, Mark, but everything you say, you know, brings up another interesting topic.
Oh, okay. It sounds like you think I'm doing at least a somewhat tolerable
job. Oh, you're covering the waterfront, no question.
Okay, well, good. I don't want Barbara to be making me broadcast from Butte, Montana next week. So I read that part of your book too.
You have to tell me. You've read it more recently than I have. What happened in Butte, Montana?
That was where your punishment was if...
Yes. Okay. Yes. All right. So I think what you're referring to, and correct me if I'm wrong here, is that as a
if
carryover from...
From
J. Edgar Hoover's time, which went from 1924 all the way up to 1972 when he died. I don't think another public servant or agency director ever had that long a tenure in the American government. But if you, as an agent, screwed up or somehow came into the disfavor of the director or one of the assistant directors in Washington, you could find yourself transferred to the Butte, Montana resident agency, which was basically, you know, a one-room office in the middle of nowhere with nothing to do. And so that was, yes, that was always one of the threats that was hanging over agents if they were perceived to screw up.
Yeah, like I don't know, I'm trying to keep Barbara happy, but with we're dealing with Joseph Paul Franklin, but that wasn't even his real name.
No, a good point you brought up. His real name was James Clayton Vaughn Jr. He was born in Mobile, Alabama on April 13th, 1950. So if he were still alive, he would be just 71.
71.
Yeah. So at a certain point, he changed his name. And this will show you kind of how screwed up he was. He changed his name to Joseph Paul Franklin. Now, the Franklin was for Benjamin Franklin, who he considered a great patriot. The Joseph Paul was for Paul Joseph Goebbels, the propaganda minister of the Nazi regime in Germany, who he also admired. So this gives you an idea of how misguided and screwed up this guy was, and his turning point really was when he was 16 and stole a copy of Mein Kampf, Hitler's memoir, from the local library, and suddenly this was an epiphany to him. The world opened up to him, and he said, ah, now I understand how the world works. And he became a Nazi, an anti-Semite. I mean, all of the things around him, the black people around him, these distant Jews who he'd never met, became his enemies. And he started having a mission. And he joined a number of these hate groups. He joined the Ku Klux Klan. He joined the National States Rights Party, which was an extreme right-wing organization. He moved up to the Washington, D.C. area and joined what was then called the National Socialist White People's Party, then became the American Nazi Party. And he found kindred spirits here. They all felt the same way, and they kind of encouraged and validated what he thought. But then something else happened, which is he was paranoid enough to realize that that these groups were, a lot of them, infiltrated by the FBI, which in fact was true, they were. And he realized that a lot of these people were all talk. They wanted to talk about how much the black people were their enemies and the Jews were their enemies, and how race mixing was going to be the decline and fall of this great white country, the United States. But they wouldn't do anything about it. And so finally, he kind of leaves these organizations and he evolves into this missionary. And this, his mission is to create a race war in the United States to actually further, through action, the goals that these other people were just espousing. And he becomes what we call a lone wolf. And, you know, you've seen other lone wolves over the years. And as I said, Dylann Roof, who killed all of the parishioners in the church in South Carolina in 2015, he was the same way. And what's very difficult is it's very difficult for law enforcement to distinguish between what we call aspiration and intent. In other words, people who may feel a certain way, but others who actually intend to do something about it. And what's interesting is when you have somebody like Dylann Roof, he had the exact same goal as Joseph Paul Franklin, which was to figure that his act of violence would inspire a race war. And when he was tried in court and sentenced to, I think, life in prison in one case and death in another, in another trial, in his federal trial, it didn't worry him because he'd figured, just as Joseph Paul Franklin figured, that when the race war happened, his people would take over and they would free him from prison. So this is the danger that we're facing. These people are true believers, and they get to a certain point and they believe in what they do, and they don't even think about the fact that what they're really doing is compensating for their own inadequacies. What they've got in almost every case, you've got two things warring within these people. You've got this deep-seated sense of inadequacy, and warring with that, competing with that, is this sense of grandiosity and entitlement that the rules don't apply to me, and I'm above all of that, and I have a special mission, and I have special entitlements that the world is not giving me. And that leads me to the triangulation of the two competing sensations, which is this sense of resentment that that society has not given him what he wanted. It didn't give him the job he wanted. It didn't give him the riches. It didn't give him the women. It didn't give him the status or whatever. And so he decides to take it upon himself, and this will give, and doing what he's doing will give him meaning. And, you know, on one level, this is obviously a very sick, perverse individual, but he was also very competent. He one of the reasons he was so difficult to catch is because he was highly mobile. He could find his way around the country easily. He supported himself by robbing banks, which he was very good at. But he was not. You know, what we call a criminal enterprise offender, somebody who commits crimes to enrich himself. This was just his way of supporting himself so that he could carry on his mission. Whenever he needed money, he would just rob a bank. And he was very good at it because he was so mobile. Also, what was very difficult is for one of the reasons he was so difficult to catch is he had more than one modus operandi. He set off bombs. He killed people with handguns at close range. He was a sniper who would pick off people from hundreds of yards away. He would wait. He would sit and wait until he could get somebody, whether it was a mixed race couple that he would find jogging in a park in Salt Lake City, whether it was Jews coming out of a Saturday morning synagogue service outside of St. Louis, Missouri. He was very resourceful. And also, he had a whole string of aliases, and he would never use the same weapon twice. He would file off the serial numbers. He would get rid of them. So this was somebody who was, while his whole view of society was completely perverse, and his relationships with people were horrible, this was somebody who was very criminally sophisticated.
And you're talking about the race war happening.
Mm-hmm. Let me interject there, Mark, that he got his idea of the race war from Charles Manson. And he mm-hmm. was a great admirer of Charles Manson, and he loved the fact, and, you know, Charles Manson said that he wanted to create a race war, which he, dubbed Helter Skelter, with his,
right.
With the two sets of murders in Los Angeles in 1969. And what Franklin really admired about Charles Manson was that he could get other people to do his violent bidding just by inspiring them with his words. This was something that was a great talent as far as Franklin was concerned. And he really hoped he could inspire others to carry out his bidding and follow his example.
Yeah, and at this time in 77, 78, Manson family had been arrested. Most of them had been convicted.
Right.
There were a few Squeaky Fromm was
right.
Still doing some stuff before she mm-hmm. was eventually imprisoned. So that was only just a few short years before Franklin's heyday.
That's right.
And Manson grew up down the street from where I'm sitting, like 20-minute drive. It's not like the Valley residents take great pride in that. You just hear about it. Since we are talking about the Manson family and his wayward philosophy, there is an interesting difference, like with the opening of your book, it's Franklin is shooting from a telephone pole few hundred yards from mm-hmm. a synagogue as the family and participants from the bar mitzvah come out after the ceremony. The Manson family murders those were done up close and personal. Yeah, you can look at Jack the Ripper. So what do these long distance snipers like Dirty Harry and mm-hmm. the intimate murders like Jack the Ripper or I forget which one. Killed Sharon Tate.
Yeah,
but close.
Yeah,
close.
I mean, it's an interesting question, and these are different type of people with different aims. I think that Manson was able to convince these kids, most of them, pretty middle class, as I recall, to do his bidding and, to come under his power. And, it's hard to account for people who would do that kind of thing, but clearly they were looking for some kind of connection and bought into his vision. What's interesting is the difference between somebody like Manson and somebody like Joseph Paul Franklin is you know, Franklin really had no other outlet. I mean, he grew up in a miserable situation and found Hitler when he was 16, and this was sort of determined his life. Charles Manson, on the other hand, he just wanted to be prominent. He wanted influence. He really wanted to be a rock star. And if he had more success, as you probably remember, you know, he was hanging out with the Beach Boys for a while and others, but he could never make it as a rock star, and so he became a star in other ways. And it sounds perverse to say, but had Charlie Manson made it as a rock star, the Tate-LaBianca murders never would have taken place. He wouldn't have felt the emotional need. But it was very important to him to have control, to be prominent, to be looked up to. And in fact, what's very interesting is you probably know that Manson was very diminutive physically. He was probably less than 5'5". And when John went to interview him in prison, first thing Manson does when he comes in is he climbs up on the table and sits on the back of a chair so that he can be up higher than John and his partner, Bob Ressler, so that he could – it was almost like he was still preaching to his congregation, if you will. And, while John did get some insights from him, he was still so interested in preaching and – spewing all his crazy radical ideas that he really wasn't much of a subject in terms of giving insight into why people commit the crimes. And John really felt that it was all about influence and power with Manson. It wasn't that he got any kind of sexual gratification from these crimes. He really thought that if he couldn't be a rock star, he could create this social movement through Helter Skelter. And I think the fact that he got these women, you know, we were talking about how women don't commit violent crimes. The fact that he could get these women to do these horrible things. And, you know, I've seen the crime scene photos from the Tate and LaBianca murder scenes, and they're just horrible. And, the fact, and I guess all of the Manson family members who are still in prison and alive today, they've seen the error of their ways. But, I mean, what they did was so depraved, so horrible that it's hard to find, you know, any forgiveness for them.
Yeah, and you and John do write about you have to feel sorry for the way some Franklin, for example, was brought up. But
sure,
like you said, it was his choice. Mm-hmm. Most of these people only show remorse that they were caught. You cover that.
Absolutely.
In Mindhunter.
Again, you've hit the nail on the head, Mark. They have remorse, but only remorse for themselves for being caught.
Yeah, and when Franklin was in jail, he did brag to some of the inmates, knocked off this guy and he was really very reluctant to admit his involvement in the shooting of Vernon Jordan, that he failed.
Right. There's two things there, I think. Yeah. One is he failed, and he considered, the fact that Jordan almost died and was in the hospital for a long time, this was not a clean kill, so he did fail. Also, Jordan was a very prominent African-American civil rights leader, and Franklin was in Marion Federal Penitentiary, and, as soon as he was sent to prison, a bunch of the black inmates knew who he was, and they attacked him with knives and razor blades, and he was almost killed. So he was very aware of the fact that he was persona non grata amongst a lot of the prisoners. So this was one that he was, though he did finally kind of admit it, this was one he was not anxious to have attached to him. And in fact, one of the things that's very interesting about him in the book and in his later life in prison is he started admitting and calling various police departments and admitting to crimes that sometimes he was suspected of, sometimes he wasn't, but that hadn't been tried for lack of evidence. And there were two things going on. One of the things is he said he wanted to get out of Marion Federal Penitentiary because he felt so threatened there and wanted to go into a state prison instead for one of his state crimes. But the other thing is, like so many of these people, like the BTK strangler and all that, you know, this was his life's work. So he really wanted the recognition too, which is, you know, it's sick again. But again, if this is your life's work, if this is the most important thing in the world to you, this is your raison d'etre, if you will, then he wanted the credit for it. He said to one of the newspaper reporters that interviewed him that he wanted to be he wanted to rack up the most capital crimes convictions of anybody in the country. I mean, it sounds weird, but, you know, these are, as we know, these are not normal people.
Right. And, you know, throughout, you know, the Killer's Shadow and Mindhunter, and speaking of, you know, the sick need for attention, you know, John, whenever the example where John was telling the media how to, you know, where we're going to catch Wayne Williams, but, you know, like going to the, but, it, you know, a lot of these, you know, the media seems to be used in a lot of these cases, you can get back to Jack the Ripper and, you know, the threatening letters to the newspapers and the police departments. And you know, how is, like, social media being used today? Is that like almost a whole new, completely different world in itself?
Well, it is and it isn't. And you know, you've brought up a topic with several interesting dynamics to it. If you want to go back to Jack the Ripper, which is, you know, generally considered one of the first serial killer cases, East End of London in the summer of 1888, and of course the media, the newspapers jumped all over this. I mean, this was just an incredibly big story, huge story. And what we believe is, you know, and we've looked at all the evidence. I went to Scotland Yard. I went through some of their files. I talked to a number of their detectives, and we tried to figure out what the police knew and when they knew it. You know, I actually became convinced, and we've written about this in our book, The Cases That Haunt Us, that the police at the end really did know who Jack the Ripper was. So we believe, you know, we believe we identified him. Other people have, you know, disagreed or have other ideas. But even the term, the name Jack the Ripper, came from a letter that was written to the police, I believe. And let's see, I can tell you who is. I've got the Cases That Haunt Us in front of me here. Let me look
it
up.
The did you think it was the Polish immigrant living?
Mm-hmm. This is called the Dear Boss Letter, and it was written to the London Central News Agency. So it was written to the media, and it was signed Jack the Ripper. We don't believe that the letter, if you analyze it, both the handwriting and what we call the psycholinguistic analysis, we don't believe this was written by the kind of person who Jack the Ripper would have had to have been. We think this was written by a member of the press, a member of the media at the time who was trying to gin up readership. Now, there was another letter that came afterwards, the From Hell letter.
Yeah, the From Hell one.
Yeah, and that we believe was written by Jack the Ripper, but the real offender. But that is much less coherent. The handwriting is worse. It doesn't make a whole lot of sense. And we believe this guy was a very sick individual. But, you know, I would say that the guy who wrote the Dear Boss letter that gave the name Jack the Ripper, I think was a pretty sick manipulative individual himself. But you know, then we come all the way up to the present with social media, and you know, as we've said, the internet puts a whole new spin on things. And let me give you an example. I mean, I started my journalistic career working for the Washington Bureau of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch newspaper, and I was on the team that covered events like the fall of Saigon from Washington, of course, and mainly Watergate and Richard Nixon's fall from grace, and all of that, and I get asked from time to time, you know, by college students who are writing papers, well, what's the difference between the Nixon era, when we had a very unpopular, controversial president, and the Trump era, when we had an unpopular, controversial president? And I think the main difference, and this will, I think, get to the heart of your question, Mark, is that in the Nixon administration and during the time of Nixon in the 1970s, we had three major networks. We had newspapers in almost every big city, sometimes two newspapers. They all got their news initially from the Associated Press, United Press International, Reuters, places like that. And basically, you know, people had different political views, but everybody was sort of consuming the same news. Everybody kind of agreed on the facts of what was happening in Vietnam, what was happening in the streets, what was happening in the ghettos, what was happening in government, whatever. You may disagree on the interpretation or whether that was a good or bad thing, but because of the news media and the way things were then, everybody kind of shared the same reality. Today, that's not true anymore. During the Trump administration, you know, we have two separate realities, whether it had to do with COVID, whether it had to do with immigration, whether it had to do with, you know, anything you can think of. There were at least two separate realities, each of them fed by their own cohorts. I mean, you have CNN and MSNBC on one side, you have Fox News on the other, you have right. all of these conspiracy theories now, you have QAnon and all of these others. So everybody's got a different reality now. So I think that's the reason it's so difficult for us to make sense of what's going on now, because, you know, we don't even agree on the facts anymore as a nation.
Mm-hmm.
That's the internet, and I think social media feeds that because it picks up on that. And you know, I don't understand exactly how Russia was supposed to have influenced the 2016 election, but clearly a lot of it was through social media. So you know, that is a real issue. And people, you know, who have the same thinking as Joseph Paul Franklin now can find kindred spirits very easily anywhere in, you know, they want.
Right. No, I think those are a very valid point. You can just sit there and look at social media, and it's a lot of groupthink. You know,
mm-hmm. Now, I'm not. I'm on Facebook. At my age, I'm not real adept at social media. I don't do Twitter, but I understand that's very influential.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can see the evolution of thought, the partitioning of America.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone just kind of joins the kindred spirits, and
yeah.
You have twenty
and
different
theories. And I
think,
you know, to pick up on what you're saying, I think one of the strengths and great liabilities of the internet is whoever your kindred spirits are, you're going to find them there.
Yeah, I just find what you and John have written about to be just really thought-provoking. And okay, so an aspect of John's the importance of the behavioral science units in the late 70s. It was a fledgling organization. Let's kind of get that Silence of the
yeah.
Lambs quote in there.
Mm-hmm.
But discuss that Thomas Harris, who consulted with John a lot, but John seems to have been the pattern for Jack Crawford.
Yeah. Well, you know, look. Well, let me back up a minute and say that
Okay. Clearly
it was Thomas Harris and his two books, Red Dragon and Silence of the Lambs, that we have to thank for the popularity or even the awareness of profiling and behavioral science in popular fiction. Now, what's ironic about this, Mark, is that what John and his colleagues did and figured out really was prefigured by the popular fiction of the previous century. If you go back and say, well, where does profiling really start? Fascinatingly, it starts with Edgar Allan Poe and his detective C. Augustin Dupin and the murders in the Rue Morgue and stories like that, and Wilkie Collins and Sir Arthur Conan Doyle and with Sherlock Holmes. These are really the original profilers. And so what evolved in the 1970s at the FBI really was a case of life imitating art. And then, of course, you come full circle, as you've mentioned, with Thomas Harris, who became fascinated by this. And so we really have come full circle. And even though there's a lot of aspects of Silence of the Lambs and Red Dragon which aren't that realistic, you're very right. I mean, Jack Crawford was the first character who was based on John Douglas. There have been many others since. The two leads, Mandy Patinkin and then Joseph Mantegna in the CBS series Criminal Minds, which has been very popular. They're all based on John. Patricia Cornwell has a character, an FBI agent based on John. Of course, the character of Holden Ford in our Mindhunter series is based directly on John. And I have to say, this is how I came into the whole enterprise. As you mentioned, I've spent a lot of my, though I've written both novels and nonfiction books, I've spent a lot of my career as a documentary filmmaker, mostly for PBS. And I had been working for the PBS science series Nova. I'd done a couple of shows for them with my producing partner Larry Klein, who's still one of the top science producers in the PBS system. And I remember coming to Nova is produced out of WGBH television in Boston, and I remember going up there and talking to Paula Apsell, the executive director, and I said, look, here's what I think we ought to do. There's this book I've read, a novel called The Silence of the Lambs, which is really a great book. It became a bestseller. They're making a movie out of it, and if the movie is anywhere near as good as the book, I think it's going to be a big hit. I mean, I didn't know how big a hit it would be, but I said, look, I think what we ought to do is, I think it would be a really interesting show if we did a show about the real story behind Silence of the Lambs. In other words, go to these profilers at the FBI Academy in Quantico, Virginia, follow them in cases, and do a film about what it's really like. And so eventually she agreed. We called the FBI. It wasn't a big thing then, so they were happy for the publicity. This was before 9/11, so it was in the 90s, so that the security was not nearly as tight, and they welcomed us in. And so we followed John's unit. I got to met him and became friendly with all the other profilers. We looked at cases and finally found a case that we wanted to focus on. We ended up producing a film called Mind of a Serial Killer, which was on PBS, and it was nominated for an Emmy. It did very well in the ratings. Actually, the behavioral science unit started getting more requests for their services every time the show was aired on PBS. And in any event, so where I come into the story again is, I get a call, the show is on, and that's that, and I go back to my real life. And I'm producing other films, and I get a call from John Douglas, and he said, listen, I'm getting ready to retire. Do you think anybody would be interested in my story? And if they are, would you like to write it with me? Would you work with me? And I said, well, I think it's fascinating. Let's see. And so I called my agent, and he was interested. We went to New York. I wrote a proposal. We did a presentation. Probably one of the smartest things I did was come up with the title Mindhunter, which was just luck on my part. And we got good offers. We ended up going with Scribner, a division of Simon & Schuster. The book became a big bestseller, and we just kept going from there. So, you know, it's funny how these things happen. You know, it sounds, the way I'm talking, like my career has had some, you know, intentional arc, but it really hasn't. I mean, I set out to become an independent writer, and, you know, I kind of took whatever came along next, and it's turned out to be an interesting adventure.
You and John wrote in Mindhunter that as a kid, he was basically good guy, but really didn't have much direction, and his...
You're talking about John?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he wanted to be a veterinarian, but
yeah.
his grades weren't good enough to get into vet school.
Yeah, and his real first profiling job was being a bouncer, looking at people's
That's
fake
right.
IDs and
mm-hmm.
stuff like
That's
that.
Right.
So
That's
it,
right.
Yeah, there's hope for me yet.
But, you know, he said, you know, back when he was still hoping to be a veterinarian, he used to go up and work on farms in upstate New York during the summer. And he said, this was actually one of his first profiling observations, too. And he could never figure out how cows could get through the fence and just roam free. And then he said he spent a whole day watching cows at the fence. And he said, I suddenly realized that if you're a cow and you want to get to the other side and you got nothing else to do all day other than, you know, chomp on grass, he says, if that's what you're interested in, you'll figure out a way to get through. And so, you know, I think there's a profiling lesson there too, which is, if that's what you're interested in, whatever it is, you'll figure out a way to get it done, even if it's, you know, even if it's a crime. And as you alluded to earlier, Mark, I mean, a lot of these criminals who turn out to be, you know, really deviant sexual criminals start out with very simple offenses, whether it's being a peeping Tom or slipping into an empty house and stealing personal items from women, like underwear or jewelry or even photographs on their dressers. And, you know, and then as they get bolder and bolder and see that this works for them and they don't get caught, they escalate and they evolve. I mean, very few of these sexual predators start out, you know, as rapists or murderers. They evolve as they learn and they get better. I hate to use the word, but they get better at what they do.
And from all of the observations that were done with Franklin, interviewing
mm-hmm.
Manson,
mm-hmm.
Gilmore, Richard Speck, was produced the John and what several others
mm-hmm.
wrote the crime classification
manual
and
yeah.
Yeah, and that became a very important book in helping to solve these crimes.
Yeah, and also figure out what you were looking at. I mean,
mm-hmm.
most people are familiar with the psychiatric handbook, which is referred to as DSM, the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, and I think it's now in its fifth or sixth edition, so it's DSM-5 or DSM-6, and that was, you know, and that was important, and it's an important book for psychologists and psychiatrists and those who want to understand the mental illnesses, but John and his colleagues realized that in behavioral science, using those kind of psychiatric terms really were not going to be helpful in solving crimes. I mean, in other words, if you say someone is a paranoid schizophrenic with antisocial or asocial tendencies, I mean, that doesn't really help you much in terms of who are you looking for, what kind of person could have committed this crime. So what they tried to do was classify crimes according to motive and what was trying to be accomplished and the type of person who would commit these crimes, whether it's a personal cause homicide, in other words, you do it because of something within you, whether it's a group cause, something that we would like the Klan might do, criminal enterprise, which would be essentially like robbing a bank or robbing somebody for money or something like that. And they decided they better start using terminology that was useful to a detective. So instead of using terms like schizophrenic or antisocial or borderline personality disorder, they broke it down into things like, is this an organized killer or offender or a disorganized killer, or is there a mixed mm-hmm. presentation? Because each aspect of it will tell you something about the person. If it's very disorganized, you're going to know this is a person who probably doesn't have a good job. He may not have a car. He may not have much money. He probably lives close to the scene, things like that. If it's organized, that will tell you some other things about him. So, you know, you build on all of these things, and then you start learning enough from experience and from the interviews to be able to start talking about, well, what's the age, what's the race of the person, what kind of job does he have, as you say, what kind of car does he drive, has he been in the military likely, has he been married or is he in a personal relationship, does he live alone, does he maybe live with an older relative? All of these things can be discerned, not necessarily proven, but they can be discerned from a lot of the behavioral evidence that's left at the crime scene. For instance, is the body, I mean, are there a lot of, is it, has there been a lot of stab wounds? Is there disfiguring of the face? Is it, you know, a kill from a long way away, like Joseph Paul Franklin? Is the body covered up? Does the person seem to have been killed at that site, or was the body transferred somewhere? All of these are behavioral clues which can let us start making some conclusions about the offender. Now, there's the cliche that, you know, it's an asocial white male in his mid-20s to early 30s, and he's nocturnal, and he doesn't dress well and all of that. But, you know, that's kind of superficial stuff. That doesn't really tell you much. What you're looking for is really elements that give you a more profound insight into what this person's like, and just as important, what is he likely to do? Or, you know, we talked about media before. John has always said that the media can be one of a detective or investigator's best friends, because if you can put out a profile, if you can start telling people through the media what kind of person this is, what kind of behavior you would expect, and say, and in some cases he would even go so far as to say, and this person has told somebody close to him what he's done, and that person is now in danger because he knows too much, so that person ought to come to the police and get him and protect himself. And, you know, that kind of thing often leads to somebody turning somebody else in. But what you're looking for is you're trying to give out enough characteristics without giving away, you know, things that the police don't want given out. You're saying, here are characteristics that this person is likely to display now that the crime has been committed, and people close to him will recognize this. That worked in a case in Seattle where a young man was setting arson fires to synagogues. Turned out he was Jewish, and and his father turned him in after recognizing these traits that were publicized. So, you know, media can strike both ways. I mean, it can hurt a case, but it can also help a case if the detective or the law enforcement officer knows how to use it. And that doesn't mean and that doesn't mean manipulating the media. It just means putting out information that other people can recognize.
Okay, and you know, Mark, we're down to about 10 minutes, and unfortunately,
well, the time goes by, doesn't it?
Oh yeah, I just happened to glance at the clock, and I thought we probably had about another 50 minutes left, but you know, we've spoken a lot about you know the murderers and you know this is a you know I've had one friend look at you know the banner and they're like oh you know I love the CSI shows but the topic's kind of creepy you know so you get that like
sure.
attraction repulsion type.
Oh look, I've got to tell you, Mark. I've had friends who said, "Well, I read the first paragraph of your book, and I couldn't get any further than that." And you know, I accept that. This is not for everybody. This is, you know, I think one of the reasons it's important to us, and one of the reasons which we think that true crime stories are so popular and have such staying power is this really is about the human condition, but it's the human condition writ large at the extremes. It's really about why people do the things they do, and that's really the essence of life. So all of the things we all experience, all the emotions, whether it's love, hate, revenge, resentment, jealousy, pride, shame, whatever. These are all the elements of true crime, but writ large and at the extremes. I mean, most of us, whether we feel these emotions, we can control ourselves. The people who don't are the ones that we write about and their victims. And I think, I hope we give people more of an understanding of that human condition through what we write.
Yeah, and you know, since you just brought up the victims, you know, one of the points I wanted to make before the show wraps was, you know, you and John do write early on in The Killer Shadow. This was the most gratifying part of the job, helping bring justice to those victims and their families. You know,
absolutely.
We personalized and glorified the victims.
Yes.
Too often. You know, all the attention goes to
absolutely
you know, a murderer, but
the criminal is never the hero ever. And and you know, even though some people put themselves in risky positions, we want to stress it's never the victim's fault. I mean, all this business about well, she was asking for it, or you know, whatever. No, never, ever. Nobody deserves to be the victim of a crime under any circumstances.
Yeah, and it, that does show through in your works as well. And
let me just say, I'm sorry to interrupt, Mark, but let me just say, John and I have also become very close emotionally with the families of a number of murder victims, and I think one of the reasons is, well, certainly, you know, we approached them because we wanted to write about their cases and wanted to learn about them and learn about, you know, the real personality of the person who was killed. But I think one of the reasons we've been able to do that is because we realize that these are complete human beings. They are more than just the tragedy that happened to them, and the fact that we can deal with them on that level, I think they relate to, and which is why, you know, I have to say so many of our close friends now are the families of murder victims.
You know, it's just interesting how trauma brings people together.
Yes,
and
absolutely.
Do you want to promote your website and where people can get
your books?
Yeah, well,
I mean, the website, it's mainly informational, but the website is mindhuntersinc.com, mindhuntersinc.com. The company that John and I formed to write these books and do consulting is called Mindhunters Incorporated, so that's where that comes from. And all of our books, from Mindhunter up through Journey into Darkness, Obsession, I'm trying to remember them now all in order, The Anatomy of Motive, The Cases That Haunt Us, Law and Disorder, The Killer Across the Table, and now The Killer's Shadow are all available on Amazon and at your local Barnes & Noble or other bookstores. We also promote independent bookstores, so wherever. And they're also, most of them are available as, they're all available as Kindle. Most are available as audiobooks. And here's an interesting thing. Our last book, The Killer Across the Table, the audiobook was done, was read by Jonathan Groff, who played the John Douglas character on Mindhunter. We got him to do it. The Killer's Shadow is read by Holt McCallany, who plays the other FBI agent on Mindhunter. So they became good friends of ours, the two actors, and we love the reading that each of them did for those two books.
Okay. Maybe just a quick question. It's still have pages full of stuff. maybe we could just kind of wrap up with an easy question.
Okay.
Tie everything together. In the Killer's Shadow, and we know early on who the subject is.
Yeah.
It's not your typical whodunit where we find out the last couple minutes that Norman Bates was the killer of
right.
Psycho or the last page of an Agatha Christie novel. But is your ability to keep the story going, you know, the audience knows who the bad guy is, but it is – you know, introducing more information and, you know, keeping the reader spellbound, is that some of Rod's influence on your writing?
I sure
writing?
Hope so. I think so. First of all, I mean, his tremendous compassion for humanity and looking for all the dimensions of how people live, not just the top people. And, you know, in some cases, the mystery is what's important, trying to figure out who did it. In the book we're writing now, which is going to be called When a Killer Calls, I'm writing it right now, be out sometime later this year or early next year, the mystery really is who did it. We kind of know why, but who did it? In this case, we know from the beginning who did it, and the question is why and how, and what can we learn about other people, other killers, and also what does this tell us about our own society? So, you know, I think you've hit on a sort of a major point of the craft, which is What are you looking for when you write? And I have a very simple formula for all of my writing, which is if I can get the reader to want to know what happens next, no matter where you are in the story, if you want to know what happens next, then I've succeeded. And so, you know, I think a lot of what we talk about is the analysis. I think one of the reasons our books have been successful is because we show how the profiling program works. I mean, we're not giving away anything that's going to help criminals. We've proven that over and over again. But just to give an insight into how it all works, how you build a profile, how you follow it, how you interact with local police and detectives, that's all part of the story. So if I can keep my readers interested, you know, that's what I'm looking for.
You do a great job at that. Okay.
Well,
so we're down to seconds, so I want to tie things in like Rod did in his Twilight Zone. So end up with Clarice had the waffles stopped cooking. So thank you, Mark. Thanks, Barbara, for producing the show, and we'll see everyone Sunday night. Thank you. Good night.